Seattle Kraken have played a game, and the banner is up. Yet another banner is up at Amalie Arena in Tampa Bay. Opening night was a lot of fun. Oh, man, Sean, there's so much more to come. But that was a heck of a good start right there. And ESPN back, the jingle. Everybody seemed to love that. So good start on opening night as we record this Wednesday morning. The game's Tuesday night, two of them in the books. So much more to come.
Well, if that was the beginning, I can't wait for the end because it was unbelievable. It was a great night of hockey. Only two games, it felt like there were 20. There was so much going on. I mean, so many great storylines, right? The Kraken started their season opening night in Vegas, like Vegas could only do it. You know, in the first game, the defending Stanley Cup champions, and Brian Boyle steals the show. I loved it. Loved it. The smile on his face could have lit up our new office with how happy he was. And the smile on my face sitting on the couch watching it might have been just as bright. He's, you know, we've talked about some good guys in hockey. He's among the best. And he signed a contract that morning and scored that night. That's a Hollywood movie.
It really is. And I got to tell you, so I'm here in Tampa. I'm flying home today. It's Wednesday. And by the way, on Monday, I was able to sit down with Steven Stamkos for a one-on-one interview that we're going to play for you shortly. So definitely stay tuned for that. But so, Sean, I'm walking to the rink, and you know the walk to the rink here in Tampa. You got to walk down. You're walking past the JW Marriott, and out comes Brian Boyle and Teddy Bluger from the JW to go to the rink. And a couple of guys were stopping them for autographs. Of course, they have to put their masks on, and they did. And then I sort of stopped, put my mask on, chatted with Brian Boyle a little bit, walked with him, and I asked him what he was doing last year because he didn't play. And he's like skating a little bit, and I was a pretty bit of a virtual kindergarten instructor too for his son, you know, and doing a lot of the things that we all were doing. I mean, I was a virtual kindergarten instructor too, but just talking to him about the excitement that he had to be back in the league, the honor he feels to get another opportunity. So it was big for him. And then he goes out, and that wasn't just a goal, man. That was a goal scorer's goal that he scored for the Pittsburgh Penguins. And to me, Sean, that's a sign. That's another important player for this team. They get a 6-2 win against the Tampa Bay Lightning. They don't have Crosby. They don't have Malkin. They don't have Jake Guentzel. Crosby's in the building, and so is Guentzel. They'll be back soon. Malkin will not. It's a sustainability thing with the Penguins. But what we saw last night is what we're going to have to see from them. Guys like Brian Boyle and Danton Heinen stepping up. Them playing just an aggressive forechecking in-your-face game, but no risk involved. It's about sustainability for them, I think. But Mike Sullivan proved last night how good of a coach he is. And he's going to have to continue to do that throughout the course of this early part of the season as they have to try to manage without some key guys.
Yeah, for sure. And look, it was a great coaching matchup. You had the Canadian coach against the U.S. skate coach in the Olympics. So you knew there was going to be some chess match going on. I look at the Penguins and everybody gets excited, and I'm excited for Brian Boyle, but you know, it is sustainability. How long can those guys prosper in matchups that are not advantageous to them, right? You got a Tampa Bay team who might have been a little off early in that game after all the celebrations that went on, the banner raising, the memories of the past, unbelievable national anthem, everything that went on, come a little flat out of the gate and never really got their footing. I mean, look, afterwards, John Cooper said we could have played Scranton and Wilkes-Barre, which is Pittsburgh's farm team, and we might have lost to them. So he was not happy with his team. Mike Sullivan has to be happy, but you have to wonder, you know, Brian Boyle, Rodriguez, all those guys, how long can they survive in matchups? They're punching above their weight right now because they're waiting for guys to come back. When they settle in to where they belong, it's going to be good. But when they're fighting up one weight class, you know, anybody can do that for a couple of rounds, but then you get into the championship rounds and that's when you start to lose that advantage. So it is a sustainability thing for them.
By the way, a little backstory too, you know, the elevator in Tampa, Sean, you know it well, it's like a freight elevator that goes up to the press box. Well, coming down late in the third period yesterday, this was actually before all the empty net nonsense was going on, right, where they scored five goals in 5-on-6, 6-on-5 situations. I get into the elevator, and there is Sidney Crosby talking with Scotty Bowman. So that happened, which was pretty cool, all right? That was just, to me, I just kind of was like, all right, we're back. You know, it was like, it was so good to be back in the buildings. You didn't see, couldn't see things like that from covering games from my home office and what things like that, covering games from my home office. So it's good to be back in the buildings. But yeah, look, the Penguins, it's still going to be tough sledding. And that's a hard way to play. Like the way they want to play, that identity that they have and they want to build, continue to build, like we both said, sustainability, it's just a hard way to play for so long. They're going to need that infusion. They're going to get it from Crosby and Gensel, but it's still going to be a challenge. And still, it comes down, Sean, it's still going to come down to Tristan Jarry. And I thought he was good last night in the opener, and that was important for him. He's coming off a terrible playoff series. And even Mike Sullivan said, it's a big win for him. It really was. Tristan Jarry has to, he is their most important player right now. He has to get off to a good start to feel good about his game. It's a good game one. Let's see where it goes from here for Tristan Jarry, but that's going to be probably the most important thing because they can play that style. If they don't get the goaltending, it's going to be for naught. And then that style is going to wane a little bit too.
Yeah, you can't be chasing goals playing that style. Once you open up, teams are going to eat you up. So if your goalie's giving up bad goals, you're behind the eight ball already. But I have a question for you. So you're on the elevator with arguably the best coach in the history of hockey and Sidney Crosby, perhaps top five players in the history of hockey.
Yeah.
And you just listened. You didn't, as the greatest podcast host ever, you didn't interject and say, hey, I have an opinion here.
No, I spoke with both of them. Come on. Of course I jumped right in. You don't just,
jump
right in.
That's my boy.
Absolutely. You jump right in. I was chatting with both of them. And
did you plug at the rink?
Not to the two of them. I should have. I really should have. That's a miss. That's a big miss on my part.
Well, we've had Scotty on. Now we just need to get Sid on. You got to ask them. Hey, yeah. You're doing nothing, Sid. How about next week?
Doing nothing. I wouldn't be surprised if that guy's playing by the weekend. Okay. So he was skating yesterday. He came out in the morning skate. Him and Jake Gensel both came out in the morning skate. That's the thing too. Pittsburgh's going to get those guys back and they're going to have to continue to play this way, even with those guys. And it still comes down to Jarry. So like we said, sustainability for the Penguins. Let's flip it to Seattle though. Like, Ryan Donato becomes an answer to a trivia question, scoring the first goal for the Seattle Kraken, 11:32 into the second period. They lose the game 4-3, but Sean, I think we saw a lot from the Kraken in one game to say to ourselves, this team, as we all expected, is going to be for real. Tough 40 hours for them with all the COVID stuff that they had to deal with. They come, they get some of their guys back. They're in the lineup. There was a lot of uncertainty, a 3-0 deficit. And then all of a sudden they fight back. They show that they do have a little bit of offense. They show that resiliency. They showed a lot in one game to show me, like we all thought, we got to watch them.
Forget about what they showed you. It's what they showed themselves, right? They're down 3-0.
Yeah,
everything's going the wrong way. The train is completely off the tracks. The crowd is banana land. Somehow they figure out a way to get all the way back, and then they lose on a kind of a fluky goal off a skate and in. So, you know, I thought it was interesting in the lead up to that game. A lot of the Vegas players that are still around from the beginning talked about how important that first game was for them. It gave them a belief and they ran with it and they won a bunch of games and they got more and more confident. I think, you know, for Seattle, they can be almost as confident in coming back from 3-0 on the road against what a lot of people think will be a Final Four team this year, and to do it in the way they did it. And the other thing I was thinking when Ryan Donato scored is you look at that team and you wonder who the guys are that are like the guys who helped Vegas be really good, who the key misfits were. And is Ryan Donato maybe their William Karlsson? Very similar trajectories, right? Mm-hmm. William Karlsson never scored more than 9 goals before he joined the Vegas Golden Knights. He was 23 years old at the time, finally given a big chance, and off to the races he went. Ryan Donato, second round pick, 24 years old, has never scored more than 14 goals. That was with Minnesota a couple of years ago. Maybe he gets that chance and he runs with it. And I'll tell you what, they're going to have to score goals like Ryan Donato's goal. Mm-hmm. That's how they're going to score. There's not going to be a Sidney Crosby coming down the wing with the kickstand and firing away. It's going to be a lot of grit and everything else. So, you know, it's fun to watch them and try and identify who those pieces are.
They're going to score some goals like Morgan Geekie scored, which is, you know, with just a terrific snipe over, you know, that Lehner didn't really get in time. They're going to have to score a lot of goals like Donato scored. And maybe he is again. And by the way, like, you look at Vegas and all the changes that they've had. What's the constant? Carlson, Marchessault, Riley Smith. Still together. Still playing good, you know. So, yeah, Donato is an interesting one. Harvard educated, by the way. But you mentioned fluky goal. Can we talk about this Chandler Stephenson goal? Because it goes in off of his skate. Small picture, it's the winning goal in one game that of 82 for both teams. Big picture, I love the fact that that goal stays on the board. I think a couple of years ago, that goal doesn't stay on the board. There's a change in that rule, a change in that philosophy with distinct kicking motion. Brian Boucher on the ESPN broadcast, and by the way, we'll talk a little bit about ESPN as well. I thought they had a real solid debut. Boucher made a great point. Like, he turns his skate. He doesn't wind up and kick. He turns his skate and he angles the puck into the net. And maybe that was on purpose, but that's it. Why are we want offense? We can't take that goal off the board. I love the fact that that goal stayed on the board, and I want to see more goals stay on the board. You know, when that happens like that, it is a bit of a murky waters that you're stepping into, because what's distinct and what's not. That wasn't, in my opinion, distinct. I like that that stayed on the board. I know why Seattle was upset, but if it was reversed, and let's say that's Brandon Tanev and the puck is going off his skate, they're probably saying the same thing that Vegas is saying. Like, what did I do wrong? Like, of course that's a goal. And we want offense. We want goals on the board. Keep it on the board. I like that. What's your opinion on it?
Well, we should reward skill. And I think that's a skill.
Yeah.
Right. Think about what he had to do to make that happen. Right. He's standing there, guys draped all over him, traffic everywhere. Puck comes in. He's got to turn his skate, keep his balance, and direct it somewhere. Like, it's not just a blind hope. Like, he knows what he's doing. To me, it's like telling Patrick Mahomes he can't throw the ball underhand anymore or sidearm, because quarterbacks only throw the ball overhand. And that's the safest way for it to happen. Like, if that had bounced off his knee pad, nobody's saying a word. Well, there's a great goal. He scored it off his butt. He's a guy that goes to the net. He should get rewarded for that. Same thing here. Like, if you're around the goalie and you're kicking like you're trying to score a field goal, that should be blown dead every single time. If you're angling your skate to put a puck in the net, good for you.
Yeah, and that's the thing. When you have a distinct kicking motion, you're swiping your foot back and forward, and then you're swiping your skate blade back and forward, and that becomes a player safety issue, a danger issue. This was an angle. It was a turn of the skate, and if we see more goals like that, because like you said, it's skill to be able to do something like that, I am all for it as long as those goals stay on the board. ESPN, Sean, I wasn't able to watch the first game on ESPN because I was watching it live in the building, but I caught a lot of the second one. Thought it was a solid debut. And did you see I believe it was like the 6-minute video narrated by Justin Bieber with the guy who created the jingle for, you know, hockey on ESPN, NHL on ESPN, and the history of that, how it came about. And then when he comes in with the orchestra and he start playing, like, I was having tingles just watching that. And I didn't watch it until long after the night was over of hockey, because I couldn't see the pregame stuff that was going on because I was in the building.
Well, that's because you were at the tiki bar too long.
No. No tiki bar on this trip, by the way. I will tell you that. No tiki bar.
It's not open yet, right?
It's open.
That's the only reason.
It's there. It's open.
It wasn't open during the final. So, and look, it's all that crossover, right? Justin Bieber is the perfect guy to do that. He's a hockey fan. He's hugely popular. You know, you're going to bring in maybe a bit of a new crowd. Same thing, you know, this week, Harry Styles played golf with the Sebastian Aho.
Yeah, I saw that.
And, you know, the Hurricanes, rightfully so, made a huge deal out of it. They changed their Twitter name to the Hurricanes. Like, they had a lot of fun with it. And you know, there's some traditionalists that are like, oh, my God, why are you letting these people into the tent? You let these people into the tent because they're going to bring other cool people with them that maybe you like better, or just make the sport more popular, which is good for all of us. So I thought they did a great job. What I really enjoyed, and you didn't get to hear it because you were covering that game, I love Sean McDonough on hockey. Mm. He's such a good announcer, and he's so understated, and he just, you know, he let Ray Ferraro explain the game, right? He set it up and he let Ray do his bit, and they had Emily Kaplan between the benches, and I thought she did a really good job. look, there were some, were there opening night glitches? Yeah. The Tampa Bay Lightning had opening night glitches too. And everybody's just willing to write that off as, oh, well, it's their first game, they'll get better. This is the worldwide leader, self-proclaimed, but the worldwide leader. They know how to do sports. They're going to get better at it. They have a bunch of people under that tent who care deeply about hockey and will force them to move forward.
Yeah, and they're putting resources towards it. I love the fact that they had a set outside at Amalie Arena with, you know, Chelios and Messier and Barry Melrose and Steve Levy on it. Levy, by the way, I don't know how he got away without wearing the tie. Everybody else had a tie on, but Steve Levy didn't. I have to have a conversation. He went casual. Everyone else is going formal. But anyway, the Lightning. And this will lead into, you know, the one-on-one we did with, I did with Steven Stamkos. But man, that wasn't a good night for them, you know, so that wasn't a good night. And I thought John Cooper had a very interesting take, you know, when he said that Andre Vasilevsky was the only player that really came to play, and he was pretty good. And everybody else was sort of in the same boat. And then he adds, and it was a sinking boat, which is a Cooper line, but it's a refocus for them. I don't think it's an alarming thing for them. I think they'll be fine, but it's going to take a little time, I think, for Tampa to really figure out the identity that they have now with the players that they lost. It's all well and good to say, well, we got Corey Perry, we got Pierre-Edouard Bellemare, we believe in Matthew Joseph, we believe in Ross Colton, we still have Patrick Maroon. That's fine. You know, Taylor Radish makes his NHL debut last night. We believe in him. That's fine. Got to make it work. And they already showed some line juggling last night. It was a bad night for them for a host of different reasons. I think they'll respond well, but it's going to take some time for them to really figure out a new identity, because part of the identity of the teams that won the past two Stanley Cup championships was forged by that third line. And that third line is gone. And we've talked about it all offseason about what they're missing. It's going to be hard to replace. And I think we saw it in game one. It's going to be hard to replace them. They're bottom six guys. I don't have the analytic numbers in front of me, but from just the eye test of watching, they got caved in on possession numbers. They were in the defensive zone a lot.
You know who smiled after he said that the ship was sinking? After he turned his back on all you guys and started to walk down the hallway?
Coop.
Yeah,
because he knew it was a good line.
No, not because he knew it was a good line, because he knows he can take that tape. And he yeah. can put it on this morning and he can say, wake the hell up, boys. The party's over.
Yep.
The party's over. Here's what you look like last night. You should be ashamed. You should feel shame. This is not a championship team. You're going to get that effort from every team you play this year. You better get your heads out of your you-know-wheres and apply yourself. And I thought it was interesting. I think it was Ray Ferraro on the broadcast said that John Cooper talked a little bit about how this isn't on autopilot anymore. Last year, he didn't have to do anything. He had a team that ran itself. It was a bunch of veteran guys. They brought in a couple of guys at the deadline, but that team had won. They knew what they were about. They stayed together as a group, and it was continuous. It's not continuous now. You mentioned all the guys that have come in. There's a new identity there. There's some complacency there. And I think John Cooper knows that he's got to be the hands-on coach he was that led them to the first championship if they want to be good again. And I think he's relishing that opportunity. I'm sure he didn't mind sitting back a little and letting Stamkos and Killorn and all those guys kind of run the ship last year, because he knew he had a veteran team that knew how to win. But now he's going to have to coach again. And you saw a little bit of it in game one, and you're going to see more of it. And you're going to see more of that psychological stuff that I think sets John Cooper apart from a lot of other coaches. So I think, you know, as upset as he was to stand behind the bench and watch that, I think he was probably just a tad bit happy to have that piece of weaponry in his arsenal to kind of shake the cobwebs out of these guys and say, here's what we're looking at.
No doubt about it. And you know what? I talked with Steven Stamkos about John Cooper and his coaching style in the interview that I did with him. It was on Monday, so it was before the 6-2 loss against the Pittsburgh Penguins to open the season. But he was kind enough to sit down with me at Amalie Arena after practice Monday. Here's that interview with Steven Stamkos. Steven, thanks so much for doing this with us. So the word three-peat, you hear it thrown around a ton now, especially around here. What do you think of with three-peat? What does that word mean to you right now as you embark on this journey to potentially do it?
Yeah, it's not something you really ever envisioned of talking about as a player, to be honest. It's pretty amazing that we're talking about this. But I think the thing with this group, and it was the same thing last year, was, yeah, we believe we can win. That's been our mindset for a long time here in Tampa. The expectation is that high. But it's trying, you know, it's tough, but trying not to get too far ahead of ourselves. And that's what can kind of creep in when you start talking about, you know, going back-to-back before it happens, three-peat. You know, that's the end goal. But the goal right now is to get off to a good start and get ourselves set up into a playoff position. We realize, you know, what we can do once we get there. Our group has proven that the last couple of years. We have that experience to fall back on. We just don't want to get caught up in getting a little too far ahead. But it's a good thing to be saying. it means things have gone, you know, very well the past couple of seasons. So if anything, it's a little extra motivation for us.
But here's, that's the thing. Like, everybody wants to talk about that now, right? But you can't do that until you play 82 games and you play them well. So I guess describe the emotion and the feeling that you have knowing, like, you have to grind. Like, this is, you don't get the opportunity unless you earn it.
Right. And it's, and if anything, we can fall back on, you know, what we did last year and how we kind of embraced that challenge, you know, especially missing our best player in Cooch for the whole year. Yeah. We knew it wasn't going to be easy, but we knew if we could just get to the playoffs. And that's why we didn't care. You know, we finished third in the division. It wasn't a big deal for us. At the end of the day, we wanted to just get in. If we had to go start on the road, you know, so be it. And we did that. And I think that's where the maturity of our group come playoff time has really grown the past few years, is let's just get there. And so I think that can help our group. You know, you look at some of the guys that we've brought in too. I know we've lost some really good players, but we've brought in some veteran guys that have been around this league for a long time, that have won in this league, that play their best at that time of the year. So let's get there first and then worry about the three-peat. Yeah. And I think that's the mindset we've had so far in camp anyways.
I wanted to bring up Corey Perry with you later on, but you just brought up veteran guys. I mean, he's a guy you've beaten in the Stanley Cup final the last 2 years, but you know his history, the type of player he is. What does Corey Perry bring to this group now at his age and with what he has experienced?
Well, I think he's severely underrated in the terms that he's still an elite, you know, playmaker out there. When the puck is on his stick, good things happen. And he puts himself in great positions in front of the net with his size and his strength. But the past couple of years, you look at what he's done to help his teams get to the finals. You know, kind of forget the regular season. Yeah. You know, Corey Perry comes out when the lights are shining the brightest in the playoffs. And I've had a privilege of playing with Pairs a couple times at some Team Canada events, and he's the same way. The bigger the game, the more he's involved in whatever different, you know, avenue that he chooses, whether it's, you know, being a little rat out there, getting under guys' skin, whether it's scoring a big goal or making a big play. He just turns it on at the right time. And you know, he was a guy we wanted last year too. You know, just talking to the guys in the room, you know, we wanted a guy like Corey Perry on our team. So when the opportunity came this year, you know, the players were pushing hard for it. I know Julian had to stick handle some things with our cap situation, but he's going to be a big part. We've seen it already in the preseason, you know, what he still has left in the tank, which is a lot.
And he's part of that, it's a new year, new team philosophy, right? I mean, we know who you lost, right? We can go through the names, the four big guys in your, you know, the depth guys that you had and how big they were. I mean, Yanni Gord, Blake Coleman, Barclay Gaudreau, Tyler Johnson. But he's a part of the replacement for those guys. So how significant of a loss are we talking here for this team, especially when the core is intact? And can it be replaced, or do you just have to sort of replicate it in different ways with those guys?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, you're never going to, you know, go out and replace the exact players that we lost. I mean, we lost some guys that were obviously very big pieces of our team. And, you know, you look at Coleman and Gaudreau, what they were able to do in the year and a half that they were both here was pretty special. You lose Gordo and Johnny, who have been kind of staples of this core for a very long time. You know, Savard, and like you said, the list goes on. All those guys are quality people and quality players and helped us win. But the reality is we're going to lose guys. And you just try to bring in guys that, you know, they may not play the exact same way, but they're going to help our team in maybe ways that the other guys couldn't, and vice versa. So, you know, we can't worry about what we've lost at this point. We're only excited about what we're able to bring in. We mm-hmm. wish those guys all the best, but this is our group now. Like you mentioned, you know, the main core pieces are still here. We still have the best goalie in the world, the best defenseman in the world, some of the best forwards in the world. Our power play is intact, and our top six forwards, our top four D. So it's, there's still a lot of positives. Mm-hmm. And then you bring those guys in, you know, Belmar and Perry and Bogo's back.
Yeah.
He understands what it's like here. You bring in a veteran goalie to help Vasi, you know, and Elliott. So a lot of great pieces. You know, we'll have to wait and see how they work out. But like I said, so far, you know, the transition's been seamless for them and how they fit into our room. Mm-hmm. You know, they're great, great people first and foremost, and that's why they're here.
I remember once talking with Marty Brodeur about the Devils and when they were winning in 95 and then 2000 and 2003. He said, when we would bring in new players, it created a new motivation to want to win again for those guys. Now, some of the guys that you brought in have experienced it already, but, you know, to want to win again so those guys experience it with us. Is that part of it for you?
Absolutely. I think a perfect example was last year with David Savard when he came in. You know, it's tough. Sometimes you catch yourself talking about and reminiscing, and then you realize there's a guy that wasn't on that team, and you know, you don't feel bad, but you almost feel a little guilty. Yeah. Like, I wish you were a part of that too, because the feeling was so amazing. Mm-hmm. And you know, Pears is, at least he's won one, because he's heard a lot of stuff about that Montreal and the Dallas series already. So I feel bad for him, but at least he had it. He has a cup already. But yeah, you look at, you know, Elliott and Belmar and, you know, some of the guys over the years, yeah, you absolutely want to win it with them, because you want them to know what it feels like, because it's, there's really no better feeling in sport than accomplishing mm-hmm. your dream. So for sure, that's definitely a motivation.
The thing you hear a lot about now is short off season, long run, short off season. How are their bodies going to come back? But there were short seasons too. It was a 56 game season last year. It was around 70 games the year before that, with a long break after that. Does the fact that those were shorter seasons, although normal playoffs, and obviously in 2020 a completely different type of playoff, the fact that they were shorter seasons, does that help you? Is that something you have going for you in your favor, or does this even matter
as you start a new season? I don't think we've really even thought of that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, last year, it was 56 games, but it just felt like every other night you were playing. Like mm-hmm. It was literally every other night. It was a condensed schedule. It was a little bit of a grind that way. So, but I don't think we've seen that. I mean, anytime you go through the grind of a season, you go all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals, it's going to be a short off season. That's what we want as players, and that's what you get for being a good team. And, you know, you're never going to – that shouldn't be, you know, a back pocket excuse for our group. You know, we still had some time to get guys healthy after last year's run, and – you know, it really hasn't seemed to be an issue. Guys really haven't talked about it. Guys are feeling better than they did, you know, our last game, which is great. And like I said, ready or not, we're starting. Yeah. But for the most part, guys have seen that they're ready and excited to face this challenge.
We're doing this on Monday, and John Cooper's extension was announced today, a 3-year contract extension for the coach, who's the longest tenured coach in the league. You've had him. You've been here the whole time. Ups and downs, this and that, whatever it may be, as would normally be with any coach who's here for a while. But what is it about Coop's coaching style that is lasting for a group? Because so often you hear about it, you know, eventually it wears thin, whatever it is with coaches. I'm sure you've had it. Their coaching styles have worn thin. Players react different ways, need to make a change. It's not the case with Coop, at least not now.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, he's not a in-your-face, yelling, screaming type of coach. So I think that can kind of wear off a little bit. He's kind of the opposite, where things are, you know, he's thought about what he's going to say. He's thought about his approach. He's methodical in that mm-hmm. way. I mean, he uses the lawyer background a little bit. He knows how to read the room and talk to a group of guys. So I think he definitely has that going for him. And listen, he's just like a player, you know, learns and gets better and improves throughout their career in order to stay good. You know, he's done the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, he came into the league as a young coach, you know, just like a young player would come in, and he's learned a lot of things, what worked, what hasn't worked. So he's always evolving. But, you know, for the most part, you know, he lets the guys, you know, we obviously have a system and we need to stay true to that system, but he doesn't really try to take anything away from you as a player, especially the offensive guys and things to that nature. You live and learn as you go on as a player, and he's done that as a coach as well. And you just look at his track record at every, you know, league that he's coached at, he's found a way to win, and that's the impressive part. So, you know, it goes hand in hand. You have to have a good team to be a good coach, and you have to have a good coach to be a good team. And we found that balance here in Tampa, I think, really over the last, you know, 7-8 years, where we've, you know, been in contention all those years. And it's, you know, usually when things are going well, everyone is feeling good about themselves, and it's been a good fit, obviously.
You have to have a good goalie to be a good coach, too.
Right. That might be the most important thing.
That's the most important thing. It's a coach killer. You don't have a good goalie, you don't have a coach. You're a good coach. This is the way it is. A couple more things. This was brought up on a call with new TNT, so obviously the new TV partners, but Keith Jones said this, and in response to a question I asked him about you guys, the Lightning, he said the Florida Panthers weren't an obstacle for them until last year, midway through the year and into the playoffs, and that maybe presents a new obstacle and a new challenge for the Lightning, but also a new opportunity. What does it mean that the Panthers are good now? Obviously it means they're a tougher team to play against, but just the idea of what that means for your team, for the state.
I think it's great for, you know, the state of hockey in Florida. We saw that last year, and I would agree. I mean, you really get a sense of building that, you know, that hatred for a team by playing each other in the playoffs. And you can talk the regular season up all you want until you face a team in the playoffs and you really get a feel for each other. That's when that stuff starts to build and that rivalry. Yeah. We were always, you know, everyone
you
always tried
them, right?
to build up the Sunshine State rivalry. There was never a rivalry there. And for the past couple of years, they've been a really good team, and we finally play them in the playoffs, and then it just exploded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want to say, you know, we hate them and they hate us, but there's the competitive juices are flowing. Yeah. We saw it in preseason again this year. We saw how exciting and entertaining that series was last year. They're a contender, and we know that, and obviously they know we are too. So it's great for the game. I mean, you look at that roster, they're pretty stacked, and they've added some really good players this offseason as well. So they're going to be an obstacle for sure. We're going to be competing with them, you know, this year and on.
Yeah.
But I think it's just great for the game. They have some amazing, young, talented players that are probably a little underrated around the league just because they're just starting to get that notoriety now. And that was one hell of a playoff series last year, and I think it's just going to get bigger and better.
That's what Jonesy said. He said it might have been the best series of the entire playoffs, you know, the way it was played, the physicality, the scoring, the intensity of it. You know, it was a rivalry that was developing, no question. Two more for you. One on Olympics. So there's a possibility, you know, that you might finally get that monkey off your back, right? I mean, it's there for the opportunity is there. Does it serve as motivation for you to have the potential to find? I know you got sort of robbed of it from a leg injury, and then 2018 didn't happen, and 2010 you were on the fringe but young.
Yeah, it just hasn't worked out, but absolutely. I mean, I realize it's, you know, I have to have a really good start. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the depth chart of Team Canada, it's pretty remarkable the talent level that we have. So but it's definitely in the back of my mind, absolutely. Yeah. You know, first and foremost, you know, you want to win here and do anything that you can, but that would be really cool to experience that. You know, 14 was heartbreaking, you know, being named to the team and then having the leg injury and being so close to coming back but not being quite ready, and seeing Marty go and win. That was heartbreaking for me. 18, you know, NHL players don't go. So it's just like, is this meant to be or not? So, and then having, you know, won two Stanley Cups now, that would be pretty amazing to put on the resume. So, I realize the opportunity is there. I need to go out there and have a really good start, and, you know, we'll see how it goes from there. But it would be pretty amazing to get an opportunity in any capacity to make that team.
Do you want me to find the coach for you?
Yeah.
He's in the building. Last one for you. So, the biggest challenge you this team, not you personally, but this team faces in the first month, month and a half, 2 months of the season? What is it?
We just can't rest on what has happened the past 2 years. The start is critical to any season. I think even maybe a little more so for our group mm-hmm. right now. Let's get off to a really good start. We're notoriously really good starters, I think, if you look at the past couple of years. So let's stay on that course. It gives you some breathing room down the stretch when things are eventually, you know, not going to go your way in certain stretches. So especially when you have a team that has been together, you know, for as long as we have, that's when you kind of take advantage, is at the beginning of the year where some teams are just, yep. you know, feeling out their rosters. Guys are getting a chance. You know, everyone's not dialed in on their special teams, things like that, where I think our group can use that as an advantage because we've been together for so long. So that's the plan. And, you know we're going to talk about the three-peat. We know we're going to talk about the playoffs and all that. But the goal right now in starting is to get off to a really good start, and hopefully we can do that.
Awesome. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, no problem.
What a great interview, Dan. I guess it was probably that way because I wasn't involved asking the stupid questions. You got to really spread your wings and get the best out of Steven Stamkos. But I thought he was great at so many things. The one that I really enjoyed was the rivalry with the Florida Panthers and how it's grown. Rivalries grow out of the playoffs. We've tried to force this rivalry down everybody's throats for 2 decades now. Oh, the two Florida teams, but they've rarely been good at the same time. There hasn't been a natural rivalry there. And then they play in the playoffs this year. They were both good last year and they play in the playoffs, and it was a nasty, fun series. It was fun to play and it was fun to watch. And then of course they play a couple of times in the preseason because they're less than 3 hours from each other. Met a couple of times in neutral parts around the state to kind of grow the game. And they were mean, nasty preseason games. That's when you know how a rivalry has grown, because nobody wants to do that in the preseason. Everybody's like, oh, let me just get out of here alive, healthy, and move on to the next day. And that wasn't what was happening. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to that. To me, I think Florida might be the best team in that division just because of what we saw last night. Like, I think Tampa is going to scuffle a little bit here and there just because of the mileage that's on them. And Florida is such a hungry team. And every time they play Tampa Bay, that's going to be like the playoffs for them. And I don't think it is for Tampa Bay as much. So I thought he was great on that.
Agree with you. I love that point that he was making about the rivalry. He said it. He said what you just said, that it wasn't a rivalry. It just didn't exist. Everybody talked about the two Florida teams, but there was no rivalry. There was no hatred. There was none of that. There is now. And not only that, and you brought it up too, the Panthers are now an obstacle for the Lightning. In the previous years, they were not. They were last year, finally. Now they are a legitimate obstacle for the Lightning and maybe a better team than them right now, you know, as you said. And they might very well be a better team than them right now. We'll see where it goes for Tampa Bay with how they sort things out. But also, with what's happened in Florida, you know, with the success the Panthers are having, Joel Quenneville being there, now they're trying to turn this, and I think they're doing it into sort of a destination spot also for free agents. And a big part of that is getting your best players to buy in. Alexander Barkov has bought in, 8-year contract, one of a couple that were signed across the league. That is so huge for the Florida Panthers. This guy is among the best players in the league. Selke Trophy winner. Wouldn't be surprised if he was in the Hart Trophy conversation this season. And he's buying into what the Florida Panthers are doing right now. And if he's buying in, you're going to get other players around the league to notice that, especially if they have success. And Sean, that's going to be a big thing. That's what Florida really has never had, to be a destination place. And there's still work to be done, but it's becoming that.
Yeah. Who doesn't want to go to Florida? Right, especially in the middle of winter, shorts to work, golf in the afternoon, you can't beat it. But no, they are. And I think back to the playoffs last year, and that series was really close. And there were two differences to me. One, Vasilevsky was a better goalie than any of the three goalies that Florida put into the net.
And you just said it, three goalies.
Yeah, and the fact that they put three goalies in. So if they had a goalie, you know, that was playing well at that time, maybe things are different. And if they had Aaron Ekblad, maybe things are different. And they have Ekblad back. And You know, we talked about it last week, and I said that he was the best defenseman. Well, I said Weegar was the best defenseman in my bold prediction, and you mentioned Ekblad and Hedman. And hey, by the way, Hedman looked great last night. Wow, what a difference when you're healthy.
Yeah, he did. He is. He actually he was on a different boat than everybody else too.
Yeah, and but Ekblad's such a huge part of what they do. He is their Hedman. He wasn't there. So that's 28 minutes a game you've lost. 28 almost flawless minutes of a game you've lost. And now he's back, and let's see what he looks like after, you know, being out for a long time with an injury. But I think they're going to be really, really good, and I think they're really hungry. You know, it's not like they've been good and then they were down and now they're back. Like Barkov and Ekblad and all of those guys, they've never tasted what they want to taste so bad. So I think it's going to be all gas, no break for that team.
Yeah, they never even got close. And by the way, we talk about goaltending. I'll go back to my bold prediction from last week when I said Spencer Knight is going to take over as the number one goalie for the Florida Panthers and win the Calder Trophy. We'll get in a little trophy discussion later on, but that was my bold prediction. But that's all we'll talk about in terms of the bold predictions. I'm not even going to let you get a word in right there. Oh, wait, I will. I'll let you get a word in. Go ahead.
Bold prediction.
Well, it was bold enough for me. They do have a guy making 10 mil in net as well. So there is something to be said for that as well. So I'll make another bold prediction for you that Nick Suzuki is going to the contract that the Montreal Canadiens signed for Nick Suzuki. It's going to be a bargain in like 3 or 4 years for him. 8-year deal, $63 million, 7.875 AAV. It's a 22-year-old center who had 41 points last year in 56 games. That's a 60-point pace over an 82-game season. He had 41 in 71 games the year before, so he improved overall his point-per-game production. He's a solid two-way centerman. They've been searching for a number one center there for a long time. I think this guy is it. They traded Max Pacioretty to get him, and this is Mark Bergevin getting ahead. I think $7.875 million is a lot right now for Nick Suzuki. I think it's going to be a bargain in 3 years.
How many guys have gone to Montreal and been the savior? Right? Jonathan Drouin, Pacioretty, the guy that they traded for. They go into Montreal and you're like, oh, this is the guy. He's going to be great. He's going to be the best. And then he gets eaten alive. They're never what you think they are. It's a huge gamble. Look, if you're right, he's vastly underpaid at the end of that deal. If you're wrong, oh boy, you're in a lot of trouble.
But you're not thinking you're going to be wrong if you're Mark Bergevin. You're seeing what you've got, and you're seeing over two seasons what this guy has delivered for you at such a young age. And you're looking at it and saying, I project this. He also had 16 points in the playoffs last year. You're looking at it and saying, I project this guy out to be close to a point per game player this season, if not this season, next season. And I'm saying he's also going to be on my penalty kill. He's going to be on my power play. There's a lot to like here for Nick Suzuki, and you're buying years off of him right now that could cost you a heck of a lot more if his trajectory continues the way it is. And that's what they're banking on. That's what you're buying here.
Yeah, but you're buying. Look, it's easy to project a guy on his entry-level contract. I project he's going to do this, and I project he's going to do that. And there's no assets going out the door. Now you're projecting something and you're putting that weight on a player. You're putting an $8 million weight on a player who's played 127 games. And you're saying, you're the guy. You're the guy that's going to lead us out of this current wilderness we have, where we have no centers and we lost our best defenseman and we don't know when we're getting our number one goalie back. And our fans don't care because we're the Montreal Canadiens and we're going to be good always and forever. And you go be that guy for us. And oh, by the way, just do it right now at 22 with 120 games under your belt. That is a ginormous amount of pressure to put on a player.
So are you saying you would have gone short term with him?
Yeah. You could do this deal at the end of this year. You don't think, even if he was a point per game player,
The end of this year, if he's a point per game player, he might want to go short term. And why would he? You know, he might say, "I'll take less years, more money now, and then it'll increase my earning potential in 3-4 years from now too."
So, but what's the difference, right? It's going to be $3 million. Let's say,
right?
You wait. It's going to be $3 million.
Well, he could be a $10 million center if his trajectory comes up. He could be worthy of being a $10 million center in 3 years.
So that's $3 million.
It's a little less, but yeah.
Yeah. So
it's a lot of money in a cap world.
The cap's going to start going up again by then. It's not a huge amount of money, and it's a far more calculated risk at that point. He can't go anywhere. It's Brady Tkachuk all over again. He can't go anywhere.
Do you want to deal with that?
Brady knows what he's worth. You don't have to deal with it. You give him the money at that point. To me, it's just a huge, huge risk in that market. I think you could do it in another market. I think you could do it in Carolina. You could take that guy and you could say, you're my guy. You could even do it at, well, Florida. He's older, Barkov, and he's far more proven. I mean, those are similar deals. You're giving one to a guy that's been a Selke trophy candidate for years, has led the team in scoring. You're giving almost the same deal to a guy that's played 120 games in the league and it's not really done anything. He's a fine, serviceable player.
It's a difference of philosophy of what you're saying versus what Mark Bergevin is thinking. And Bergevin obviously is thinking in the long term, this deal is going to be great for the Montreal Canadiens, because that $3 million that I'm not going to have to pay Nick Suzuki in 4 or 5 years, well, that $3 million is going to come in handy elsewhere to help us continue to try to build something. So it's just a difference of philosophy. And I understand the risk you're talking about, but I like the deal. I like the risk. I like taking the risk. I think this could, from what I've seen from this particular player, I think this deal could really work out in the favor of the Montreal Canadiens. I could be dead wrong. A year from now, we could be talking about this. Like, oh my God, they still got to pay Suzuki almost $8 million a year for 8 years. Right. We don't know, but I like the calculated risk here by the Canadiens to buy years from this player that they're going to be saving. You know, they're going to be saving a lot on the back end of this deal. And he's still going to be very much in the prime of his career when the deal's over. He's only 22.
Sure. And if he gets better, that's great. But would you be happier to have that $2.5 million savings if he's a good player, or not have to pay your third line center $7 million for the last 5 years of the deal?
I don't think he's going to be a third line center. So that's the difference. There's also another 8-year deal. Let's talk about this one. And it also leads into a mailbag question I got for this week's mailbag, Over the Boards mailbag, which is on NHL.com right now. Mika Zibanejad signed an 8-year contract with the New York Rangers. I thought for sure when I saw that Zibanejad contract, Sean, not surprised, because I knew they were working on a deal. I think the Rangers would have preferred 6 years, but the 8 years I think helped keep the number down a little bit. I thought for sure, Sean, when I saw that contract, that was the captaincy was coming. Like, he was going to be given the C, because Chris Drury said in the preseason, you know, before the season, and that we think we're going to have a captain. Gerard Gallant said, we think we're going to have a captain. They both left it open to say, if it's the right guy, got to find the right guy. Well, they don't have a captain. If six alternates, somebody asked me the other day, if I got an alternate, if I got the A and I'm going to the Garden on Thursday night, maybe I'll have an A sitting in my press box seat. I'm not so sure. Six alternates, and Zibanejad's one of them. So no captain. They got the guy for the 8-year deal. I thought he would be the captain, but instead they're going with sort of a leadership group that they've had the past few years. What'd you think of that? What'd you think of six alternates instead of, you know, two alternates or three and a captain?
I don't really think much of it. I don't understand it. You can give as many letters away as you want, I guess. The leaders will assert themselves.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what Gallant's waiting for, is, you know, who's going to take charge of this room? Whose identity are we going to become? Now, if I'm not mistaken, Fox was not one of the six.
He was not one of the six. And it actually surprised me a little bit that he wasn't one of the six. Gaudreau and Panarin were the surprises to me. Panarin had worn an A for the Rangers, but he's already talked about it. He doesn't want to be the captain, and Barclay Gaudreau is new to the team. Fox wasn't, and he's the guy I've stumped for to be the captain of the New York Rangers, but he also does not have a contract yet beyond this season. So I do wonder, Sean, if they're waiting to sign him, and then Gallant has to see leadership out of him before they give him a letter, which, if I recall, 3 weeks ago is kind of exactly what you said.
Of course it is.
I'm giving you the credit.
But so this is the part I don't understand about it. You have a guy who's the Norris Trophy winner, who sets the tone for you on the ice. I can't speak to in the locker room, but clearly sets the tone on the ice, much like Artemi Panarin. And you don't want to give him a letter because he's not signed. But then you have a guy that's never played for you that you do want to give a letter to. Like, if you're just giving out A's, what does it matter? Like, give one to Adam Fox, because if you're worried about him not being signed and what's going to happen there, you deal with that next year. You know, it's not Eichel all over again. More than likely, you're going to have the guy in the fold at some point, and maybe he does become captain then, but I don't see how you don't do it now. But like I said, that's all going to sort itself out in the room. I think sometimes we make too much out of this, who wears a letter and who doesn't. I can think of players that I've covered throughout my career that never wore an A or a C that were some of the best leaders in hockey. To me, that's a non-starter. But as far as the Zibanejad contract, I kind of feel the same way I do about the Suzuki contract. And maybe I just don't like long-term contracts. Mm-hmm. Maybe in this world, I feel like you're better off, because players hit walls so fast that you're better off, you know, getting the known quantity and not gambling on years down the road, because you can always make years down the road work. You got to pay a guy a ton of money, pay him a ton of money, and then figure out how you're going to surround him after that. That's, to me, the way that it should work. Not that you should be like, I predicted 6 years this guy's going to do this, because we don't even know. Like, 6 years ago, you couldn't predict anything that's happened right now, other than that Alex Ovechkin would still be scoring goals. But other than that, you couldn't predict anything that's happened in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a 6-year deal for Zibanejad. I didn't think it was going to be an 8-year deal, but I guess the 8-year deal does, like I mentioned before, help bring down the number a little bit, because they do still have to get Fox under contract. And then they got Kako coming up and Lafreniere eventually, and we'll see what those guys get in their second deals. They have to prove a lot still. But 8-year deals all around, everybody sign them. We'll give you one too, Sean, all right?
Awesome. Job security. I love it.
Two other questions I got in the mailbag this week. I'm curious your opinion on it. Playoff hopes for the Devils, playoff hopes for the Blackhawks. Do you buy either one of these teams as being a team that will make the playoffs, the Devils or the Blackhawks?
Do I buy it? Am I getting any odds?
No.
No? Just straight up they make the playoffs?
Straight up miss or make.
I definitely don't buy it for the Devils. I just think they're in too deep with who they would have to beat out. But I think they're going to be so much better than they were. So much better. Especially if Mackenzie Blackwood can play the whole year, stays healthy, gets some help from Jonathan Bernier, so he's not playing a ton of games. I think they're way better than they were. And I think Lindy Ruff actually has something to work with now. Chicago, I feel a little more confident about just because they're getting Jonathan Toews back. And to me, that's huge. But again, there's a pretty good gauntlet to go through there. So if you're going to put me on the spot right now, I would have to say no.
Yeah, I said the same thing. And I agree with you on both. The Devils, I think, are going to be vastly improved, playing meaningful games in March and April. But so much has to break right for them. And I also mentioned this, that I think Jack Hughes and Nico Hischier, for the Devils to have a chance, Jack Hughes and Nico Hischier have to combine for in the neighborhood of 125 points, which would be a significant bump for those two. Hischier's got to stay on the ice, right? And it's another bump for Jack Hughes. If you look at it, last year, Jack Hughes was on a 45-point pace for an 82-game season. Nico Hischier, limited to only 21 games, he was on a 42-point pace for an 82-game season. So that's 87 points. I think they got to get 125. You're looking at, about 40 more points from these guys in order for the Devils to really improve. And that comes into their power play. Their power play was 28th in the league last year. Dougie Hamilton helps that. But again, I think it's asking a lot for a team that finished 26 points out of a playoff spot last year to then go ahead and make the playoffs this year. If they do that, Lindy Ruff is the coach of the year. If they're able to make up a 26-point difference, or whatever the difference is going to be, and Jack and Nico do what they're supposed to do, and Blackwood stays healthy, and Dougie Hamilton helps improve their power play and their penalty kill, which was god-awful last year, last in the league, all of a sudden improves, then Lindy Ruff has to be the coach of the year, does he not?
Yes, he does. And, you know, it's funny because we'll talk about trophies now. We did our trophy tracker. We do them every quarter. We start at the beginning of the season, and then we update it quarterly until we get to the end of the season. I think we had 22 coaches that got a vote for coach of the year, which is just unbelievable. And I don't know that Lindy Ruff got any of them. And if he did, it was very, very few. He was not very high on anybody's list. So, but yeah, no, if all that were to happen, then he would walk away with it, I think. But yeah, every other coach in the league right now, somebody at NHL.com thinks is the best coach.
I'm looking right now and I do not see Lindy Ruff's name on the list of coaches who got votes. I mean, Andre Tournier from Arizona got a vote. Sheldon Keefe got, you know, votes. Daryl Sutter, Jeremy Calton from the Blackhawks votes. But no, Lindy Ruff didn't make it on the list. But he would be very high up on that list if the Devils are going ahead and make the playoffs. Joel Quenneville was the winner. I didn't even have Joel Quenneville in my top five for the Jack Adams.
He was my number one. I think they're going to be an absolute tank this year.
Yeah, I do too. But I think the way I look at the Jack Adams sometimes is I lean toward what coach is taking a team that wasn't very good or had a lot of questions going into the season and then pushing them ahead and being a team that is a playoff team. I had Gallant number one. I had Dave Haxtell number two, and I had Travis Green number three on my list. And Quenneville was the winner. And if he were to win that trophy, I wouldn't have any issue with it at all, because I agree with you. I think the Panthers are going to be terrific this season, but I guess it's a philosophy of how you look at the Jack Adams Award winner. And I look at it in a way of saying, you know what, who's the guy that really had to take the team, had to do the work, take the team that you know, wasn't quite there or wasn't there last year and pushes them several notches ahead of where they were.
Yeah, you can look at it that way. But to me, it's who's the best coach? Who does the best job of coaching? That's why certain coaches get knocked out of this award before the season starts. Like, everybody's like, oh, Rod Brindamore can't win it again. He won it last year. Carolina's good now. If they're good, what did he do?
Yeah.
What did he do? He coached them. Like, you know, Mike Sullivan never gets any love for this award because he's won the cup. And he has Sidney Crosby and he has Evgeny Malkin. But how important is he to that team?
But I think Sullivan gets love for it this year if the Penguins go ahead and make the playoffs again based on everything they've had to do. But
he's not a different coach than he was either of the last 2 years.
No, but the job is harder. The work is harder.
I don't know that I agree with that. To me, it's the best coach who did the best job of coaching. And it can be the first place guy or it could be the last place guy. Buffalo doesn't do good. It doesn't make the playoffs, but they're better than they were last year. Nobody's going to think of Granato for that award. They're going to skip right over him. Oh, well, Buffalo still didn't make the playoffs. He's not a very good coach. He turns that team around and gets them climbing in the right direction. He's a hell of a coach.
Yeah, but that's my point on it. That's my point. I'm looking at guys who are coming in, whether they're new or they've been there, to take over a team that's maybe that team is brand new too, but they haven't had a lot of success. They didn't have success the previous year. And they've pushed it ahead. And that's what your point on Granato is. Like, they didn't have success last year. If he's able to push them ahead, that's a great coaching job. The Florida Panthers had success last year. Success for the Florida Panthers this season is going to be based on what they do in the playoffs. That's not what you get. That's not what you win the Jack Adams Award for. You win the Jack Adams Award for what you do in the regular season. The expectation is that Joel Quenneville and the Florida Panthers are going to be a really good team. I don't think you can have that same expectation for, as I mentioned, Gerard Gallant was my number one guy for the Rangers, Seattle, Vancouver. You know, there are mixed bags of expectations there. So anyway, that's...
I must have read the criteria wrong. I didn't realize that it was the Jack Adams was the most improved coach in the league. I thought it was the best coach in the league.
Well, maybe you did read the criteria wrong. Maybe they should change the criteria.
I'll have to go back and check.
Yeah, they'll change the criteria. All right. So we also our Calder, our trophy tracker, Calder, Cole Caulfield. Did you have Cole Caulfield?
No.
No. Who'd you have? Doesn't even remember.
No, I had Spencer Knight.
So did I, which I've already mentioned. Very bold, both of us. Norris Trophy, the guy was Cale Makar. I had Makar. Did you have Makar?
Hedman. Okay. Hedman and then Ekblad.
All right. No,
so I went back on my bold prediction about Uyghur.
and made Ekblad.
Yeah.
You're not going to see me argue with Victor Hedman or Aaron Ekblad, but I think Cale Makar is, that guy is so good.
Adam Fox was so far down the list.
Yeah. Well, Adam Fox was fifth on my list. You know, I think he's going to have a terrific year. I do, but I was surprised he won the Norris last year. So I don't know. I mean, Makar is the guy. Can't argue with Hedman.
You know who else is not high on that list and who I think is going to be really good again is Quinn Hughes.
He's got to bounce back a little bit. He was okay last year. He was okay. It was not a, from his rookie year to last year, it was not a progression that you would have expected from Quinn Hughes. He's got to take a big step this year.
Yeah. And I think he will.
All right. I can see that. I like Vancouver this year. So I think he's got to be a big part of it. Vezina Vasilevsky was my guy. You?
Connor Hellebuck's in the conversation.
He's in the conversation, but Vasilevsky leads the conversation. It's a very easy one right now. And Hart McDavid was the NHL.com winner. I had him second behind Nathan MacKinnon, who was not playing opening night.
Yeah, I had him lower. I think I had him lower than everybody. I had him either third or fourth.
But you don't think he's going to get 100 points?
That no, I don't. But it's not even that. Again, I must have read the criteria wrong.
You should really get reading glasses.
Look, my SATs will attest to the fact that my reader comprehension might be a little suspect. But point taken. It's the most valuable player. Like we just talked about with the coach, like Connor McDavid can score 100 points. Leon Draisaitl is going to score 95 points. Like how is Connor McDavid so much more valuable than Draisaitl because he scored 10 more points? Like to me, they kind of split the vote. They split the vote. So neither one of them is the most valuable.
Who'd you have?
MacKinnon.
Yeah. Did you have Barkov on your list?
Barkov was higher than McDavid.
I had Barkov third behind McDavid. I think McDavid could have 150 points this year. So I think that kind of...
He could, but if he has 150 points and Draisaitl has 120, because they're going to play together to start the season.
To start.
They came out yesterday and said that. And look, McDavid talked about being better. He sounded a little like Sidney Crosby. I worked on my whole game. I worked on faceoffs, my 200-foot game. You love to hear it. And look, he could be dangerous. He could be a complete wagon. And I wouldn't be surprised if he scored 140 points. But he's not as valuable as other players in this league.
I don't know how you could say that. If a guy scores 120, 130, 140 points.
He's the best player.
These are pretty valuable. He's pretty valuable.
He's the best player in the league. If we had a best player in the league award, which we don't, he would win it every time.
Yes. And I guess I have the same way of thinking. Like I look at Nathan MacKinnon, I say, Rantanen is really good. Landeskog is really good. Neither one of them are Leon Draisaitl, you know? And Nate MacKinnon really drives the whole thing for Colorado, whereas yes, there is another guy in Edmonton, but there was another guy. There's been another guy in Pittsburgh for years, and it hasn't stopped either one of those guys from being voted the Hart Trophy winner at various times. So I get that, but if McDavid goes out and averaged 1.88 points per game last year. If he's close to that this season, I'd be shocked if he didn't win the Hart Trophy. Shocked.
Okay. Well, then you can be shocked. I wouldn't. I would say he's the best player. There may well be a more valuable player.
Well, then Vasilevsky should win it every year.
You know? I have no problem with that. Yeah. Although I don't think Vasilevsky is the most valuable player on that team.
Well, that's Hedman probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like they put in another goalie whenever they have to, and he does okay because he's completely sheltered. Now I would say Connor Hellebuck.
Maybe Hellebuck. Yeah. In that way, in that neighborhood. Yeah. True. We'll see. It's a fun debate. No question about it. We do the trophy tracker.
And we have 82 games to figure it out. Yeah.
And we do the trophy tracker every quarter of the season until we do a final one right at the end of the season too. So follow along with that. Sean, before we get out of here, I did want to give some love to Emily Benjamin's story on the women officials. 10 women trying to are breaking into the American Hockey League as officials this year. I thought the story, which is on NHL.com now, was terrific. And I think just the old message of it and what it means is more inclusivity, more opportunity. And she did a great job with the story as expected, but to see these women breaking in as officials, we're going to see it in the NHL soon enough, sooner rather than later. And it's good. And we should.
Yeah. And it kind of ties into another story that Emily did recently, and that was on the skating coaches, the female skating coaches, Barb Underhill and all of those. Like, they're such good skaters. And what does a referee need?
Need to skate.
He needs to skate. He skates like 5 miles a game, right? You need to be a good skater. You need to have good fundamentals. You need to be able to skate backwards and still watch the play and not be looking down at your feet like I do. You need to be able to do all these things at high speed, think, have the stamina to do it all. And clearly each of these women is qualified to do that. And the work that the NHL officials have done, Stephen Walcombe with the exposure camp he does up in Buffalo every year to bring in male and female referees from hockey and from official feeder programs has been fantastic, right? They're investing in that part of the game, which I think is really important. If you want good officials, you have to invest in them and you have to identify them early and you have to groom them. And that's what they're doing here. And, there's some great stories there. We've done some of those stories. One of the most interesting ones to me is Anthony Mantha's sister is one of the referees that's going to do that this year. And I mean, that's a hockey family and that's a great story. Like, can you imagine she gets to the NHL? I would imagine she wouldn't be allowed to do her brother's games. Like, they would have to figure that out. But just to have both of them in the NHL in different capacities, like, that's pretty cool. Great story.
It's a great story. No, and it's great stuff. It was a great story by Emily. So definitely go check it out on NHL.com about the women breaking in to the American Hockey League as officials. And like I said, it's going to happen in the NHL soon enough. Maybe one of these women will do it. And we wish them all the best and good luck doing it. I think that's it for us, right, Sean? I mean, we got a lot of hockey to talk about still. We'll be back next week with a lot more to talk about. Anything you're looking forward to right now? I mean, you know, other than just the things, the season really kicking off here, is there one team, one player you're looking at?
No, I'm just looking when the games come hot and heavy, right? Those Thursday and Saturday nights when you can give Game Center or ESPN Plus now a workout, right? And you can jump around and you can see everything. I guess what I'm really excited about is the young players that kind of surprise that are coming into the game. A guy like Cole Perfetti in Winnipeg, I thought it was great. I love Paul Maurice. And part of the reason I love Paul Maurice is because he always gives you a good answer. Mm-hmm. And he talked about Cole Perfetti making the team. It was kind of a last minute thing. Everybody thought he was going to the AHL. And they asked him about it. And he's like, what did you tell him? And he's like, well, I thought about his parents at home and the call that he's going to make and how amazing that call is going to be, that this investment of 15 years has come to fruition. And, that's what I try and bring to the player. I told him, hey, get out of here. Go call your parents. Tell them the good news. Like, Paul Maurice is a coach and coaches are hard by their very nature, but he's also human. And like, you forget, those stories are all over the league this week. Dawson Merce is going to play his first game. The two kids in Columbus, Sillinger and Shinnikov, are going to play their first games. Like, these are great stories. These are moments that are going to pass by everybody's eye in a blink, but not for the players that did it. Tyler Radish last night, there was a clip of him on the bench, and Pat Maroon was trying to ask him, you know, where he was on a certain play, and they were trying to get that chemistry together.
Yeah.
And again, it was Ferrari's, like, he doesn't even know where he is on the ice, like in the world, never mind on the ice on that play. Like, that's his first game. What an incredible moment it is. So that's, those are the ones I'm looking forward to, is those first games, those first goals, the first everything. It's new, and it's going to be new for a couple of weeks.
It's great that it's back. So we'll be done for this week. Don't forget to go on to wherever you get your podcasts, rate and review us. Follow us on Twitter at The Rink, at DRosenNHL, at S. Rourke underscore NHL. And until next week, enjoy the hockey.